Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
How are you?
Doing great.
So tonight, why don't we talk about the differences in the length of sentences and how that how that's determined. So who determines the length of a sentence? And I think that probably should cover what we're going to go over.
Well, Andy, this is a complex issue, and we could spend multiple sessions talking about sentencing, but we can cover some basics tonight, and I'd be delighted to do that because I've just recently written an article about sentencing.
Okay.
For the NARSL newsletter.
All right. Let's start here. Is there a big difference in the way sentences are calculated at the federal level versus the state level?
Oh, there's a tremendous difference in the federal level and the state level. The federal system is much more regimented than many states in terms of how a sentence is derived and calculated. Prior to the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984, which was passed by Congress and signed by President Reagan, but there was a lot of perceived disparity and unfairness. So you would have a district like in San Francisco where a crime would get probation or a small amount of time, and then you would have the same offense code, similar criminal background, put that person in Alabama, and they would receive a sentence of many months or if not years in the federal penitentiary. So Congress decided that there was too much discretion with the federal judges to impose sentences of their choosing. So they made some dramatic changes. And so when you're dealing with the federal system, you're looking at a grid and chart system that guides the judges. They're not mandatory, they're advisory, but those guidelines are largely followed. So you start with in the federal system, you're looking at how serious the crime is, what is the potential range of punishment for that offense. And Congress decides that, not the judge. So you have a crime, for example, that may carry up to 10 years of incarceration, but then there's all these things that can compound that 10 years. And so you'll end up with a range of sentencing based on the individual's characteristics. The individual may have prior history of nullity. There may be extenuating or aggravating circumstances that will compound the severity of that sentence. So you end up with a computerized outcome of a range of sentencing that's appropriate according to the guidelines. So that when all the computations are complete, that crime should carry 97 to 105 months in prison. And so the judge very likely will sentence within that range, although there are processes they can offer a downward departure for factors. But largely, you're going to find a sentence within the range of those guidelines.
Okay. And what would be the determining factor of whether a crime goes federal or stays within the state?
Well, it would be determined by whether the feds have jurisdiction, because the federal system is limited in terms of their jurisdiction, although they've been expanding it through recent years. But federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, so there has to be a federal component to the crime. So merely killing someone would not qualify as a federal offense in most circumstances. So it's a serious crime, but it wouldn't be prosecuted federally unless it was a federal component. Now, if you were to kill the president, that would be a federal crime.
And then also then a senator or something like that, right?
I think so on that, but I'm not sure if that would be the case. But any attack on the president and possibly some other high-ranking government officials, then serious crimes on the Indian reservations were prosecuted in the federal court system. But beyond that, you have things that involve an interstate component, national banks that are chartered and operate across state lines where their commerce clause is invoked. So you have the transportation of pornography, visual images, that's deemed to be interstate. So the commerce clause is invoked. So things would be federal if there is a jurisdictional hook. So a lot of stuff that you would think would be a federal crime because it's serious. Many people think, well, it's a serious crime, it's federal. No. That's not what determines if it's federal or not. There has to be a federal jurisdictional hook.
Which I think probably, like you just said, you're trying to go after the president. But then if you do multiple crimes across state lines, if I remember right, there was the serial killer around the D.C. area. Malvo is part of the individual's name, and they were doing shots from like Virginia and then Maryland and probably even in DC. I don't even think that that went federal, but they did try them individually in the states. I think even Maryland ended up letting Virginia do it because they had a harsher penalty.
That is correct. My recollection of that case is similar. Now, a lot of federal resources were brought in to help investigate it, right? Because there was the feds could go across state lines easier. So the feds are often involved with local investigations to help with their long arms that they can reach, and no agency can match the power and reach of the federal government. But in terms of the actual prosecution, they were prosecuted in state court.
But the crime itself didn't occur across state lines. So I guess if you were to transport some contraband across state lines, feds might then have jurisdiction. If you were doing drugs or Cuban cigars or whatever, then the feds might get involved because you're moving a product across state lines.
That could trigger a jurisdictional hook. The feds like to take cases where they can have harsh sentencing. So there are things where there's the jurisdictional hook, but it wouldn't generate enough time to be worth their while in terms of incarceration. So there are things where they decline to get involved. Making obscene phone calls across state lines would be a federal crime, but they seldom get involved in that because that's not a very serious crime.
But the hackers, scheme of criminality. The computer hackers are getting severely targeted and with some heavy hands just for possibly what you might consider pranking, where there was a guy named Kevin Mitnick from the 90s, probably maybe early 2000s.
I remember Kevin.
And he served a lot of time, and I don't know the details, just kind of what I read here and there, that he may have served a lot of time without ever being charged. Because they were scared to death of the guy that he could whistle into the phone and launch nuclear weapons, because he knew how to do those kinds of things.
He was quite the hacker in terms of figuring out how the phone systems worked and how to bypass mm-hmm. all their safety and security features.
How do we approach this in as unbiased and nonpartisan as possible, and discuss where sentencing has been triggered and going through the roof? For example, this isn't any sort of speculation. Trump is saying that he's the law and order president, and you have guys like that knucklehead out in Arizona, Arpaio, who are like, if you jaywalk, they're going to lock you up forever. That's the, you know, I know that's an exaggeration, but in your experience, how would you unbiased and objectively critique which administrations have pushed for harsher sentencing and which ones have pushed for more relaxed reform kind of policies?
Well, it depends on the era of time that we're talking about. When we haven't touched on state penalties yet, but in terms of the federal, the real change in our attitudes at the national level started in the late 1960s, when we were supposedly in a crime epidemic. And President Nixon campaigned on law and order, and then it really intensified after we went into the Reagan administration. And that's when we had the Sentencing Reform Act of 84. And what they did in 84 was they practically abolished good time in the federal system compared to what there used to be. There's no parole anymore. You get 15% off, up to 15% off of your sentence. Used to be in the federal system, they had a parole eligibility period. After you'd served a segment of your time, you could be paroled if factors were met and there was a discretionary call made. They abolished that. They practically abolished good time. And then with the structured sentencing, everybody started going to prison for almost every crime. The probation percentages dropped from nearly half prior to sentencing reform to less than 10% now in the federal system receive a probated sentence. So the bulk in the federal system was pushed by conservative people on the conservative side, convincing the people that we were undergoing a crime epidemic. But even the progressives, even Bill Clinton got on the bandwagon in the 1990s, and he was willing to say that, I think Ms. Hillary was quoted as talking about predator, super predator
mm-hmm. yep.
kids. So there was some bipartisanship to the ridiculous policies. But since then, there has been, as a general rule, the progressives are more willing to look at the failure of what they see as a failure of just simply mass incarceration. And there's been some bipartisanship on that as well. There's been an effort that stalled, and I wrote about it in the article for the Narsal newsletter. There was a bipartisan effort that was moving along nicely in 2016, but once the Law and Order candidate emerged, it gave the Republicans cold feet about making concessions to reduce these harsh sentences at the federal level. It's a whole different ballgame at the state level, because each state is an independent sovereign. So when you look at state sentencing, you run the gamut from extremely harsh sentencing to much more reasonable. And it generally flows along the progressive states are a little bit more lenient and look for more diversion, and the conservative states tend to believe that punishment and incarceration is the answer. So if you look at the United States and break it down on the conservative states, you'll see the southern states typically incarcerate at a much higher rate than the more progressive states in the Midwest and the Northeast.
Would you expect that someone in Minnesota or Maine, do you think that their crime rate itself is different? Do you think that might be something that predicts the higher rates of incarceration in the South, that people down the South, maybe it's just too hot down here and people just commit more crimes because it's the temperature's up?
I posed that question at a presentation I did a couple of years ago. I haven't done enough research to say that, to pronounce that as a factor. So I posed that to a Southern audience in Dallas. Are Southerners inherently more predisposed to commit crimes? Because I had the chart up on the wall of the Southern states with their exorbitantly asinine high incarceration rates. And then I compared it to Minnesota and Maine and Vermont and places like that are much lower. And the exception, of course, there is an exception, and that was California. California had a pretty high incarceration rate, although they're perceived as a progressive state. But that was done by a citizen referendum. California has this system where the citizens can enact law through a referendum process, and the citizens enacted the three strikes, you're out. And that led to a very, very high rate of incarceration in California.
Interesting. Every state, I know that they're we've talked about this probably like on the first podcast, of that they're own individual entities, and there are probably a great more similarities, but there are those nuanced differences between them on how they enact their different rules. That's just, it's kind of a fascinating thing. Someone could probably spend their whole career analyzing the differences of how the constitutions are written.
It's fascinating to me, as being a political junkie, of watching you look at a state in the Deep South where they're not particularly sophisticated in terms of their attitudes about rehabilitation, and you see that their answer to everything is to make penalties more severe and incarcerate more people, and they eventually get forced to a day of reckoning because they're crowding out other sources of where they'd rather spend their money. So finally, it takes a conservative to come in and say, we've gone too far. You can take a governor, like the current governor of Georgia, being that he has his credentials well solidified as being a law and order conservative, he can say, we're spending too much on prisons. It's time to look at reform, and he won't get vilified.
Right.
But if you take someone who's known to be a progressive liberal and who's preached alternatives to incarceration all their life, they are vilified because they're going to turn loose a tidal wave of crime.
Right.
So it's fascinating to watch these discussions unfold in these legislatures. And then the legislatures themselves can play a role in what happens, because you've got states where they have very short-term sessions. They're in session 40 days, I believe, in Georgia. They're in session 30 to 60 days in a lot of states. They're just temporarily there. They don't have vast research staff, so they don't have the ability to really get deep into these issues and do the type of analysis that would be necessary. So they respond a lot to public pressure and what they hear from their constituents and what they hear on the news. They make decisions that are based on the hype of the day rather than really digging deep enough. And part of the reason they can't dig deep enough is simply because there's just not time in a 40-day session. With all the things that the Georgia General Assembly has to deal with, you just really can't get deep enough into the issue. So you take a state that runs a year-round legislature, they do have the capacity to dig a little deeper. And oftentimes you get better policies out of those states because they have the expertise to get beneath the surface.
And so then let's move on down to some specifics. I want to get down. I think I want to eventually ask about the economic side of it. to whatever degree we can go in. I know that neither of us are economic junkies, but so let's come up with some hypothetical examples of someone that has, whether knowingly or unknowingly, they end up with, we'll call it 10 images of some young people on their computer without some clothes on. So we'll call that child porn, versus someone that commits a pretty heinous crime, you know, some form of murder. And when you compare the two sentences, someone is never going to breathe another breath of air, and another person is victimized, but they obviously aren't dead. But the sentencing of those two things could be vastly out of whack of each other, where the child porn person might get 5 or 10 years per image, and then the murder suspect will end up with 10, 20, or something like 30 years for the homicide. How do you square those two things?
Well, we could spend an entire program on that particular question, because it's more complicated than that. We would have to know, in most cases, the murder is going to be in state court, and the porn could be in state court, and it could be in federal court. So we would have to decide, are we talking about
leave it at the state level.
Okay, well you could take a case where you had a murder. Then we would need to know, people can end up dead, but the death is pretty consistent.
Yes.
But how they ended up dead, it could be very relevant to a murder prosecution, whether you've got first degree, whether you've got second degree,
okay,
whether you've got manslaughter, what caused the person to end up dead, and how strong that case might be against the person. Because one thing a prosecutor wants to do when there's been a crime is they want a conviction. There's a victim out there, or a group of victims that are wanting someone to pay. So there are homicides where the case is not very strong, and there are homicides where the case is very strong. The case where the Fulton County Courthouse in Georgia got shot up by a guy named Nichols with lots of eyewitnesses, they had a pretty strong case against him. But all homicides are not like that. So you can end up with a one count indictment because there's only one person dead, and you can end up with a case where it's just not likely that there may be very much in doubt what level of offense you can convict that person of, what a jury would return a verdict on based on the evidence that you have. So you can end up in a position where you're trying to bargain for a conviction, and the public doesn't understand that. I can roll the dice as a prosecutor, if I'm a prosecutor, and say, well, it's either you plead the first degree murder or else. And I can go into courtroom and the jury not see the evidence there and walk the person, and then you end up with nothing. So you end up sometimes with what appears to be a very lenient sentence because the case was just not strong enough and they needed a conviction on that, so the person didn't go free, so that lent itself to a better outcome. And you know, people don't take that into account. There's all sorts of factors, like whether the person gives a statement or not, whether they have a strong forensics link to the culprit. And the stronger their case is, typically the less favorable the plea bargain is going to be to get that plea. So that could explain the difference. With the porn, you've got multiple images, and the defense of those type of cases is they're you're seldom successful, because the forensics are there. That's how they found the person.
Right.
And I can't explain all the IP stuff and all the technology in terms of how they do this, but they've pretty well got it down to a specific user. And most of the time when they do their raid on that person, they confess. They're not criminals by nature, and they confess to what they've done, and they admit that they've been downloading this stuff, and they've been and they think they're helping themselves to a lesser sentence, and they've actually talked themselves into a stronger case.
Right.
But they don't know any better. So you've got multiple counts that could result in the stacking of consecutive sentences, and I don't believe it's fair, and I think the system's out of kilter, but that's how it happened. And I tell people, I don't make the rules. I'm just telling you that that's how it can happen, but it is unfair.
Something that you mentioned a few minutes ago about prosecutors are looking for convictions. We talked, I think, episode 2 about being on supervision, and what the mandate of parole and probation was, is to help you rehabilitate and get back into society. is the mandate of a DA to get convictions or to get justice? Is that even the right question?
It is. That's actually a good question. The DAs do have a higher ethical standard for profession, and they are supposed to be seeking justice. But in their mind, many of them believe that they are. They believe. I mean, I'm not making a rosy things about prosecutors because they're unethical prosecutors, and some have been disbarred. But they believe that based on what they've got on the case, they believe they've got a strong case, and they're going to seek a conviction because they've been elected to represent the people. The reason we don't have anarchy in this country is because we have a system where everybody has agreed mostly to abide by the rules, and that the society has made the rules and standards of conduct. And we've elected these people in these roles of prosecutors, and they're supposed to be the people's representative when the people's rules are broken. And the people made the rules. The people established what constitutes criminality and what constitutes the appropriate punishment for that criminality. And it's the prosecutor's job to go out and seek redress against those people who have broken society's rules that were made collectively by the people.
Do prosecutors go home every night and they just have dinner with their wives and families and they're just like, hey, yeah, it was a great day. I kept the city safe. I mean, are they compassionate? Are they like, wow, this guy, yeah, he totally effed up, but he doesn't deserve this. Do you think that the prosecutors have those kind of internal dialogues, or do they see, hey, this person jaywalked, let's freaking nail him to the wall and, you know, firing squad?
They do both, Andy. They're just like other human beings. There are prosecutors who agonize over decisions of what the proper offense to charge is and to not overcharge people because they can. And there are prosecutors who do just the opposite. They stack charges and they labor trying to come up with the most ridiculous thing and figure that if they throw enough at the fan that it'll stick. You had a good prosecutor up in Boulder that named Alex Hunter who he and his chief deputy, whose name is escaping me at the moment, Peter Hofstrom, I think they both conducted themselves with the utmost of integrity in terms of deciding what was appropriate and trying to balance the community's interest with what would be appropriate sentencing punishment for people. Poor Alex got drummed out of office because after the Jamaday Ramsey case surfaced and they couldn't lock the Ramseys up fast enough to suit the community, the people that were hollering for vengeance, his fortunes plummeted in the polls, and he had an internal challenge against him from someone who worked in the office, and he was he's no longer district attorney there. But there are prosecutors who actually do the things that we would want prosecutors to do, and there are prosecutors who don't. But remember, they're chosen by the people.
Yeah.
At the state level, you run for district attorney or prosecutor or state's attorney, or different states have names for them, but you run for those offices. So they're direct descendants of who the people have chosen.
Mm-hmm.
So if a person can go out into DeKalb County, Georgia, and campaign on trying to be progressive and fair and win, that's the type of candidate you're going to get. If a person goes down to Houston County and runs that same campaign down in Houston County, I don't think you'd get the same reaction from the voters in Houston County that you will get in DeKalb County or possibly Clayton County or somewhere else in Metro Atlanta, where enlightened there's more enlightenment and there's more desire to seek alternatives to incarceration. So they are direct representatives and reflections of where the people are.
To cover that for a second, the will of the people, their personality, their culture is reflected in the politicians and the other elected officials that they assign. If you have an uninformed public and they're willing to believe whatever the local media station, you know, whatever ad that candidate is running, and that appeals to their inner senses, they can throw any sort of BS line at you that they want that you'll believe, that says, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. And if it appeals to that person, whether that is ethical, moral, progressive, enlightened, evolved, whatever, it might not be any of those things, but it appeals to you. So that's who they vote for. And that's the society that we have.
Unfortunately, in many instances, that is the society we have. And that's why I made the example that you would relate to, being that you've lived in rural Georgia for some time. And can you picture Can you picture the candidacy of how a campaign would be ran in DeKalb County versus how one would be ran in your local area there?
Yeah, certainly. And I'm with you. Yeah.
So you've got district attorneys and prosecutors who they're hearing from the people. I want to max these people out and give them the most harsh punishment and charge for the most serious crime and send them away for as long as possible. And when you stand before your voters and say, well, actually, I think I'm not going to do that. I'm all about rehabilitation and I'm all about rediversion from prison. That just doesn't work very well. And then you got a lot of states, particularly again in the South, where not only do they elect the prosecutors, they elect the judges.
Right.
And the state of Georgia does that. And so it's difficult for judges that are in those areas where there's the thirst for maximum sentences. It's difficult for the judges to impose anything that resembles reasonableness because they have to stand before the voters every so often. And the opponent that would like to have that cushy job as a circuit superior court judge is saying, hey, this judge is lenient on criminals. I'll keep you safe.
And I hear you and I understand the words and I get you, but it would be impossible for a candidate to stand up there and say, hey, I know you guys want this kind of policies. However, evidence says this is a more effective approach. And then the people are like, no, screw you. We want them locked up. I don't care what best policy is. If you lock them up, I feel safe. I want you to lock them up.
Well, that dialogue happened in the 2016 election. We had some rational discussion and some irrational discussion, and you see which way the people went. we had one side saying that the crime is out of control, which it isn't. We're at historical lows in this country of recent time, but we had a campaign saying how dangerous the cities are. There are some cities that have had some escalating crime, particularly in Chicago.
Yeah.
But we were told how bad off the country was. And despite all the evidence to the contrary, and the evidence is out there. If the evidence wasn't out there, I couldn't have it. So the evidence is out there that crime went down throughout the 90s and 2000s. And you're safer now being alive than any point in modern times. But yet people succumb to the notion that things were out of control and the country was in flat on its back and total despair. So I'm not so sure that dialogue that people are ready for. I mean, I would love to think that someday we will be, but I'm not sure we are.
And this goes to what you often throw at me is if we just had computers do it, if the algorithms looked at which policies worked best, then the algorithms would put it in place and that's what we would live by. End of conversation.
So we would do away with judges and prosecutors and just have the computer take care of it?
Why not? Why not have a system in place that just uses whatever the raw evidence is, whatever the statistics have determined to be, however you want to look at it. If age is a factor, I don't want to bring in any of the discriminatory factors, which age would be a discriminatory factor, but race would be, sex. If we just looked at, if you put somebody in prison for X amount of time for X crime, when they are released back in, they do not commit another crime. You could then, you know, play around in a little bit of a margin to see if we reduce it, do we still get the same effectiveness? You balance that against a certain amount of economics too, that prisons aren't cheap. And, you know, Georgia has a $1.3 billion line item in their budget of $10 billion for the prison system, which would include parole and probation. You've got a truckload of people that are on some form of supervision. And it, of course, there's some sort of absolute drawing the line on the other side of the equation of you did this crime, you go to prison either for life, capital punishment, or just for a really long time. The other side of the spectrum is you've done something so benign, so innocuous that it's not even worth anybody's time. Of course, then you have the whole spectrum in between. But we have in different jurisdictions, people commit what would appear to be the same crime. I know that there are so many varying factors, but if we could pull out as many of those and normalize the crime, you still end up with a huge disparity of sentences across the same state and certainly in different states.
Well, we do have that disparity, and there's so many factors. Like I was saying, the geographic part of Georgia that you're in, if we'll use that state as an example, if you were to do the analysis of Metro Atlanta sentencing versus rural Georgia, if you took the same statutory offense and looked at the sentence, you would generally find that more diversion was offered to those offenders in the metro area. They have more resources there, and that's more of in common with their thinking of diverting people from prison versus just that's the only option to warehouse them. But studying people once they've been in prison is kind of difficult because some people commit crimes because they can, and some people commit crimes because they feel it's the only necessity. This done out of necessity because of economic, social standing and barriers to. If you're living in East St. Louis in some poverty, or Gary, Indiana, or some place where there are very few economic opportunities, it's a whole different thing than if you're living in a vibrant place where there's lots of jobs and opportunity. So you take a person who never gained the skills to compete in a modern economy to start with. If you put that person in prison and you put a person who actually had the skills, but they did the crime because it was quick and easy, and they didn't want to have to make the commitment to working, you put them away for an equal amount of time. If there's no rehabilitation done to that person who came from poverty and from despair, that person is going to be walking out of prison with the same skill set they walked in with. So the person who did the crime because they could, because it made them feel good for the rush of it, they may not commit another crime. And the person who committed the crime because of other reasons and factors, without additional training and rehabilitation, they may commit another crime. So you just can't look at that alone, in my opinion, to determine that there's this magic formula in terms of how long someone should stay in prison, because we got to know what's done while they're in prison that could affect what happens when they leave.
Right. So is then, I think we're going to cover this on another episode, though, but is putting someone in prison, is that rehabilitation or punishment?
Well, it depends on the attitude of society. There was a time in the United States and at the federal level where we felt that rehabilitation was the goal, and that kind of wound down after the 70s expired. When we moved into the 80s, we've been drifting away from fewer and fewer programs and more and more of it's just a warehouse, and that's an unfortunate thing. We were more there was what was referred to as the medical model, that people committed crimes because they were lacking something and they could be fixed. And we've gotten away from that, but there are states that are still somewhat more progressive. If you were to commit a crime in Vermont, you would find that the system in Vermont would be far more in tune with wanting to make sure that we make that person better than if you commit a crime in Alabama or Mississippi. So the purpose of whether it's rehabilitation or punishment, some people say it's for both, but which way it leans is going to be more representative of the attitudes of the people that make up that particular jurisdiction. So in some states it's going to be more driven towards rehabilitation, and some states it's going to be more driven towards hard time. If you were in Joe Arpaio's custody and you had been convicted of a misdemeanor offense, which is what sheriffs are responsible, Joe believed that you were there to be punished and that you should suffer
and wear pink underwear
and suffer in any way that he could find a way to make it unpleasant. His policy was, the harder it is, the more likely you are not to come back.
140 degrees outside and hot showers.
So I don't know that the statistics bore out that was the result, but that was his belief, and it resonated with the voters of Maricopa County, Arizona. Just recently, I mean, he served like 4 or 5 terms as sheriff.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So help me out with how the expression goes, but the states are designed to be their own little democratic experiments, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So doesn't that make a natural experiment to say, hey, well, this state, you could say that, you know, roughly geographically the same, you know, so North and South Carolina are similar, North Carolina with Virginia, you could say that they're roughly similar, so they would share attributes about them, about climate, geography, etc., that State A has this kind of policy. This is the recidivism rate. This is the budget per capita, you know, balance things out. These policies work better than this other state, State B, similar demographics, all the things, but they do these other things and they spend 50% more on prisons, yet recidivism rate is the same, whatever. So why would they continue to support those policies given that there's not, you know, you're losing something around the edges because you've gone past what is effective. I guess another way to word that would be if it's 100 degrees outside and you set your air conditioner on 50, it is not going to get any colder than 80 degrees in your house. So just leave it set on like 81 or 82 and let the thing turn off. You're not gaining anything by setting it on 50.
Well, you actually are. You're gaining emotional satisfaction for the people who want folks to suffer. And for the Maricopa County example, the voters felt really good that the inmates were being abused and malnourished and suffering in the heat and the humiliation. So you're getting that. And even though you may not be getting any rehabilitation, if you lock people up for a long period of time, they certainly are not committing crimes on the general population for the period of time, and to the citizen population, they may be committing crimes in prison. So you've cut the recidivism down pretty low while they're incarcerated.
Certainly.
So you are gaining that level of, but at what cost? I agree with you. At what cost are you getting that little edge of? But if you lock a person up for life that's had three minor felonies, you are stopping them from continued felony conduct. But the funny thing is, they would have stopped themselves when they got older anyway.
Likely, yeah.
Yeah, because they age out of criminality, and it's more of a young person's game. So if you let them age out of it, there's no point to keep a person run a geriatric prison, because the older in age, the more their health care costs, the more problems you have with an older and older population in prison. So you would have gotten some of those results anyway. But what you get out of it is it makes people feel good. And in our democratic system, things are done that make people feel good that are not necessarily the best policies.
Yeah, I'm still back to that computer model. And we were discussing something that I was doing at work. I don't care if it is, let me word it the other way. I am interested in effectiveness. I don't care if your feelings get hurt. I need the results. If the statistics bear out that we're doing the wrong thing, then we need to change what we're doing to be doing the right thing, to become more profitable. I mean, that's what it boils down to. The economics of the person that's trying to get elected is they want to get reelected. The incentive model is screwed up, that if you just make the person happy by doing what makes them feel good, it has nothing to do whether it's effective or not. You've just done what made them feel good. Then the economic model, the incentive system for them in that position is warped. There should be some sort of performance metric on justice served, which sounds like it would be completely subjective to whoever wants to evaluate whether they are completing that job or not. And we don't have a very informed public to know that just because the person locked them up, well, they think that made them a super duper prosecutor, when in fact they locked up a whole bunch of old ladies who were gambling, playing some bridge games, and they locked them up for a big cartel.
So, I agree with you that our system is not perfect in terms of the results that we have. But in a democratic system, I don't know of any other way, because I don't think the public is ready to surrender public policy to the machine.
I know that.
And so therefore, that's not likely to happen anytime soon. And with all the factors on variables, we claim we want individualized determinations. People, particularly when they're on the receiving end of the criminal justice system, they want an individualized determination. And there are things that I'm not convinced that a computer can take into consideration. I'm not sure if I'm sitting on in judgment of someone in terms of whether they get released or whether they be pretrial detained, and I'm hearing witnesses, I'm not sure the computer can evaluate the veracity of those witnesses and ask them the questions that would need to be asked in terms about putting the proper controls and constraints on the people to try to minimize the threat to public safety. Because there again, we don't lock everybody up pretrial. We lock up too many, in my view, pretrial because of our cash bail bond system, which is a discussion for someday in the future.
Mm-hmm. But yes.
But we have the computer can't do that interaction. Can Alexa evaluate the veracity of a witness?
Yeah, you bring that up. I hadn't exactly considered that point. And I'm just thinking about the way that you are able to type anything into the better search engine, and you get a pretty damn good result back based on what you typed in. They are getting really good at intent. However, could somebody sit up there on the witness stand and the computer evaluate whether that speech, whether the person was lying, sincere, etc. That would be an interesting challenge. But I was, from the computer standpoint, I wasn't necessarily thinking about the computer evaluating the innocent or guilty. I was, and we've been mostly talking about the sentencing. That's where I was actually thinking that you could just feed it in 1,000 different metrics and it would come back with the most appropriate sentence duration.
Possible you could do that. It's kind of what the sentencing guidelines were designed to do, was to feed in a lot of metrics and come up with a range of sentencing. But the sometimes an individual defendant has a sentence fashioned based on that, on what that judge hears that's testified to about how they've responded, any counseling they've gotten, and how receptive they are to therapeutic intervention, what type of support structure they have on the outside, how reliable those people are. Yes, you can tell the computer that they have support, but the judge can actually hear from that person in terms of, yes, I employ him, he's here on time, he's a vital part of this company, and we're standing behind that person. So sometimes sentencing can hinge on whether or not the person gets a community based sentence versus an incarceration or a combination thereof, based on what the judge hears at a sentencing hearing and the memorandum that's written. So I'm not so sure we're ready to go to the computer model, but that is kind of where we started headed with the sentencing guidelines of the federal system, because the public said, we're told that there's just too many people getting slapped on them. We don't want that. If the judges can't control themselves, we're going to control them. But when you find yourself getting a mandatory sentence, amazingly, you're not so much in favor of that anymore.
Right. You just mentioned mandatory minimums. Where did those fit into this whole equation?
And can you clarify the question a
little
bit?
Well, so you get convicted of the thing, whatever that thing is, and I guess some time ago, it was then the judge's discretion to say, hey, I give you 1 year, I give you 50 years. But then somewhere, I don't know when they would have started, is mandatory minimums started kicking in. And now the judges aren't even in the mix anymore. So who is responsible for the duration of a sentence? Is it the jury? Is it the judge? Is it the legislators?
Well, the severity and the potential penalty is defined by the legislative branch. So if something is on state level offenses, you'll hear the term class one or class A felony down to various levels of felony. Or a capital offense. So the citizens determine through their elected officials how severe a crime is, or whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. And more things magically become felonies, because as the crime rate has dropped in America, the one way to keep the machine filled with defendants is to make more things felonies. But so that's determined by the people. So like in I'll use my state, for example, a class 4-3 felony is the most minimal felony, and it carries a basic sentence of up to 18 months. But the judge in that level of felony does not have to impose incarceration. But if the judge on more severe felonies, there's a mandatory term that's been determined by the legislature, and they'll say that this offense carries a minimum of 3 and up to whatever. Well, then it's a mix between the judge having to impose the minimum, and the judge can go all the way up to the maximum that level of crime can have applied. So if it's a felony that carries up to 9 years with a minimum of 3, the judge is going to impose the 3, but may impose all the way up to the 9.
It would be really hard to speculate about a crime that would fit the legal definition of having crossed that boundary to have, let's just say, some murder charge. Here in Georgia, it's 21 years. But, you know, depending on the circumstances, yada, 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 it on paper, it is that. But it is, you know, once you actually go through the trial and all that, then it turns out to be like, well, there were extenuating circumstances. So they just legalized medicinal use marijuana stuff, like the oils and stuff in Georgia. But leading up to that, so there's a father whose kid is having just horrible seizures, like 20, 40 seizures per day. And the only thing that helps the kid is to have this marijuana oil. And Georgia couldn't quite handle making that legal. So now the guy's got to go travel out of state to get the stuff and bring it back in. So now he's trafficking drugs across state lines. 2, help his child have a reasonably normal life. So in that type of situation, and I know that that scenario is real, at least, you know, I heard of, like, I read it in a newspaper. And so then this guy ends up getting brought up on charges. So his intent is not anything bad. It's not criminal. It's nothing. He's just trying to provide for his kid. But on paper, he has broken the law. So perhaps they would send him off to jail. The judge has no discretion to allow him, saying, hey, look, you broke the law. I have to do something to you, so I fine you a penny. But no, the legislators have said, because you've done this horrible thing, then you get whatever, 5 years, whatever that number would be. I don't know.
Well, there would be more options. I would have to know the statutory scheme and if it was something that would allow for probation. But beyond that, you could seek a jury nullification by taking something like that to trial, because you could argue that there's no criminal intent. If you went to a progressive place like Boulder, Colorado, we were talking about earlier, they don't even bring drug cases. It's hardly ever simple drug cases, because you couldn't get a jury in Boulder to convict anybody. They just wouldn't do it.
Right.
They've moved past that. But if you took that case over to Sumter County, Georgia, which is Plains, if you took that same, you'd more likely have a lot of much older, very old people who are more traditional in their values. And they would say, well, by golly, I ain't no believer in that kind of stuff. And that's going to lead to something else. The first thing you know, we've got this whole town is overrun with all these drugs. And they'd be much more likely to convict that person. So jury nullification wouldn't necessarily be an option in some areas. But if the judge had a mandatory sentence, the judge would really have no choice other than resigning from the bench if probation and a modest fine or no fine at all was an option. But there again, that goes back to the people. The people made those rules. The judge didn't.
Right. I was just about to try and drill back down into that again about the culture, the local culture, is what is determining what is legal and what is not legal, regardless of what might be going on in other places. You know, they influence each other for sure. But whereas, you know, the states that have legalized it, 20 something states now, and then you have other states that are still, you know, like our attorney general is, he's just like, all drugs are bad, and we are going to prosecute to the fullest extent of the law for the most benign of substances.
He believes it's a gateway to, or at least that's what he says to his constituents, that he believes it's a gateway. But that would all change if the citizen said, sir, you're wrong.
But they he's wrong in 20 whatever states.
But that's not in this state. Doesn't matter about those 20 states. He's Attorney General of Georgia.
No, I'm and talking about Jeff Sessions. He's the Attorney General of the United States. So he has a great deal of power to go push back. I think, even though the states have legalized it, if I'm not mistaken, how this kind of got worded is that Obama said, hey, we're not going to go prosecute this stuff. So I don't know exactly how that works, where he says the attorney general, don't do that. Well, now they've legalized it and they have all this production stuff going on. I assume that in those states that I know that in Colorado, they have been pulling in some pretty good tax revenue. And now you could have an attorney general that says, hey, we're going to go throw the DEA at you. And they start doing raids on all of the quote unquote legal production facilities in these states.
It is a potential nightmare that could happen. And there again, but the people elected Donald Trump, who appointed Jeff Sessions. He didn't come out of a vacuum.
Yeah, I know.
He came out of a candidate who told the people America is undergoing a tidal wave of crime. Obama is turning loose the druggies and making our streets unsafe. The people voted for that.
Yeah.
Enough of them that he's occupying the Oval Office. So this is a direct reflection of what they think the people instructed them to do. If their phone started ringing off the hook incessantly, Mr. Sessions, you're wrong. We will repudiate Mr. Trump at the polls when we get the next opportunity. That would change. But that's not what they're hearing. They're hearing hip, hip, hooray from their base that this is what the people want, and that's what they're doing. But yes, that is a disaster waiting to happen, because the U.S. federal government's Controlled Substances Act still classifies marijuana as an illegal drug, and it's prosecutable
as the worst kind too, is like equivalent to cocaine and other Schedule One. If I'm not mistaken,
Schedule One.
I believe that is
I'm waiting for that. And they've prevented these businesses that are legal in the state from having access to banking relationships. So they're operating on huge sums of cash, which is a security nightmare. You know, they're put out of the financial system because of they're breaking the law. The feds control the financial system.
I believe that they had opened that up to some degree where they had made it so that they could stop dealing just in total cash. I thought that they had before the turnover of the new administration. I'm not sure where that stands now. And we've gone like completely off the rails, but we're still talking about sentencing. So to bring that back in, the feds could go after all these states that have legalized it and have production facilities, and those people would go away for an incredibly long time when you're sitting on hundreds of acres of marijuana growing.
And I think that the shrewdness of the Trump administration, I think that they'll calculate that very carefully before they go down that path. And so the states that are doing this, as they multiply, it makes it less feasible for them to take that course of action. But it is a fear that if the drumbeats get loud enough and they perceive that's what the people want, they could start prosecuting people in federal court for what's legal in state in their state.
That's that possibly is an episode on its own.
So
do you have anything else? We're at 55 minutes or so. I think we should probably wrap it up here in a second.
We've had a great discussion, Andy, and like I say, we could spend a lot of time on sentencing and the complexity of sentencing, and we didn't even touch on how plea bargains play into sentencing. So, we can do this again. I'd be delighted to talk about sentencing another time.
We'll bring up an episode of talking about plea bargains versus taking it to trial, because it's probably like 95%. Take a plea bargain. So that's probably an episode on its own, and that might even tie in with the bond system stuff.
We could definitely tie the bond system to those who are not able to get out of jail, how that impacts the likelihood of them taking a plea and the distress they're under to take a plea. So yeah, that would be a great topic.
Larry, thank you so very much. I appreciate it again, as always.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Have a question? Send an email message to registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or you can leave a message at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website registrymatters.co. This is episode 6. Music is Downtown by Ben Sound. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would really appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.